Hi, I'm Chris, and welcome to Foundations in Social Innovation. So today we're starting on our journey to explore systems. And in this module, we're going to be looking at how to think in systems. And in the modules that follow, how to model systems, how to act in systems, and how to tell the story of systems. This podcast is being recorded on unceded Kaurna land, and I'd like to pay my respects to Kaurna elders past, present, and future. And I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands on which you're listening today. For systems thinkers, our failure to behave systemically is nothing less than the very root of our despair. Inequality, climate emergency, poor mental health arise directly because we don't see and think and act in systems. Donella Meadows, one of the foremost systems thinkers, put it this way. The world is a complex, interconnected, finite, ecological, social, psychological, economic system. We treat it as if it were not, as if it were divisible, separable, simple, and infinite. Our persistent, intractable global problems arise directly from this mismatch. So systems thinking gives us a way to understand the state we're in, but it also offers a way out. And a systemic view provides a way to unite our principles of practice at TACSI, people power and innovation. The complex interaction between elements in systems means that it's hard to predict what will work in advance. Rather, you have to learn what works in the present and in context. And this is where innovation practices come in. And in systems, power structures, who gets to decide, are recognised as a high leverage point for change. And this gives the theoretical underpinning to participatory, deliberative, and self-determined processes, all processes that shift who decides. Systems is now a very wide school of thinking and practice. It's very easy to get lost in it. I think I've been lost in it for a couple of years now. It's got both the technical side, which has got its roots in engineering, and a much more spiritual side, a side that asks us to explore our inner selves, our inner world in relation to the world around us. And we're going to explore both of these sides because it's all relevant. We're going to start with a talk from Peter Senge, author of The Fifth Discipline. It's a talk he gave at Aalto University in Finland a few years back. And I like Peter because his work embraces both the technical and the spiritual. And also, he seems to be a friend, a colleague, or a co-author of nearly every other systems thinker we'll touch on here. I find his approach really human, and I like the way he avoids jargon, including the word systems. We'd be in a much better place, he says, saying we're talking about life or the world, rather than to use this language of systems.
Please give a warm welcome to Peter Senge.
I grew up in Los Angeles, and the most powerful experience, beside all the time outdoors playing baseball and with all my friends, the most vivid experience I had over a period of about 13 or 14 years is watching paradise disappear. When I was a young child growing up in Los Angeles, I can remember sitting in the back seat of my mother and father's car, driving for hours and hours, and all we would see is lemon groves and orange groves. It's kind of hard to imagine this today because, of course, they're all completely gone, disappeared within about 10 years. Whoosh! Shopping malls and housing developments had replaced all the orange groves and lemon groves. And it's kind of hard to imagine it today. I'm sure many of you have visited Los Angeles. You certainly see it represented in countless films and television shows. It really was paradise. I mean, it was an incredibly beautiful place. The weather was perfect. The air was clear. There were trees, palm trees, and the orange and lemon groves everywhere. And it was amazing how rapidly that occurred, and probably no coincidence that it was kind of synchronous with my own youth. So at the early stages of my youth, I can remember that vividly, and by the time it was time to go off to college, we would have many days when we'd be warned by the city government that children should not go outside because the air pollution was dangerous. And the place I grew up was surrounded by mountains, but by the time it was time to go to college, you only saw the mountains a few days every month. So that happened very quickly, and it made me very aware of something, a dynamic which I would say is probably the dynamic in some ways that unfolds around the world. But of course, because it unfolds around the world, we don't experience it around the world, we experience it in localities. I spend about a month a year in China for the last almost 15 years now. And of course, what I lived through in Los Angeles, the people in China lived through very quickly. All of a sudden, boom, the air is unsafe, you can't really see anything, the forests are gone, and in place of them are buildings and roads and lots of cars. I think I was probably about 17 or 18 years old. I kind of have this recollection of a conversation with my mother. And of course, again, all of this is hindsight, but I think it's relatively accurate. When I said something like, well, it seems to me there's one problem in the world, and all the problems in the world arise out of this one problem. And as I understood it then, the problem was interdependence. That interdependence is life. I often think it's important for us in this systems field just to remember that systems is just a word. It's become the word, kind of the mainstream scientific word, you might say, systems and complexity, the kind of two mainstream scientific words, to say something which people have understood as long as people have understood anything. We do not live alone. We have never lived alone. We live in a world of extraordinary interdependence. This is a sensibility which defines, in many ways, native awareness. And by native, I mean before the Industrial Revolution, of course, but really before the Agricultural Revolution. Because many people who have reflected on the evolution of culture would probably say that was the first fundamental break, in many ways defined. And of course, it's embodied in almost all of our Axial Age religions. Not all, but most of them, sometimes very explicit, because those religions had their roots in a time period very similar to the beginnings of organized agriculture, during which time human beings go through this profound shift. There was no word for nature. Most native communities have no word for nature. You do not need a word for something that is you. They all have words for Mother Earth. They all have ways of talking about the human in the sky, Mother Earth, Father Heaven. Well, lots of words like that show up in native cultures everywhere. But the word nature is an abstraction. It's very familiar to us because we live in that abstraction. Because somewhere during that journey, in some places of the world, probably as long as 4,000 or 5,000 years ago, probably a little more recently, but in many places of the world, literally in the last few hundred years, all of a sudden, the human and nature are two separate things. So while I know I didn't say it that way when I was 17 years old, what I did say was something like, it's very clear to me that we've built this extraordinary web of interdependence. Now, you might say it's a web layered on top of a web. Life is interdependence. There is no such thing as living separate. That we inherit. That all species inherit. But on top of that web, we build a second web. Because for sure, this is, as far as any of us know, the first time in human history where simple daily acts are everyday ways of living. Very mundane things, like we plug it into the wall, right? Very few of us think of this as an ethical action, charging our device, whatever that device might be. But of course, that device uses electricity. That electricity has to come from someplace. It does not actually come from the socket in the wall, right? It comes from an electronic grid, a grid that moves electricity all over this part of the world. My guess is here most of it comes from fossil fuels imported probably from Russia. In my country, about 70% of electricity comes from burning coal. And I always try to remind people, we get caught up. We're kind of, I would say dazzled might be a good word, by our technology. But we have to realize none of it works. None of it works if we don't plug it into the wall and burn former living things. So next time we think we're so sophisticated, we should remember we burn shit to make the device work. That's how it works. But of course, we don't see that system because that's a system we've layered on top of the innate system that defines living. So systems on top of systems. And what I was most aware of, having that experience as a child growing up in Paradise Lost, if I can reuse a old phrase, was the total out of control nature of the process. Because I'm quite certain if you'd brought together any group of people, children like me, adults, people in government, people in business, people in the middle of the development, boom, because of course all of what happened in Los Angeles was driven 99% by private development and the opportunity to exploit possibilities for building things and making money. But if you had asked any of those people, this is a way of talking about that. I know I didn't quite understand them, but I felt it. If you had asked any of those people, do you want to destroy the orange groves and the lemon groves? Do you want to destroy the possibility for children playing outside? Do you want to destroy the possibility that children can walk to school by themselves? Do you want to destroy the air? Of course, they would have all said no. How many of us want to destroy species? Really? You wake up in the morning and go, ah, what a beautiful day to destabilize the climate a bit more. Of course we don't think that way. No one wants to produce the systemic outcomes that we consistently produce. And what I started to realize is that is almost a kind of, to me, the archetypal definition of systems intelligence, or let's just say systems ignorance. One of the faces that paraded along during Raimo's presentation was a very, very dear friend, Danella Meadows. Dana and I were very close. She died way too young. And Dana was one of the most articulate writers, in my experience, in the systems world, at least in the U.S., the only environmental writer I know who ever was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize. I mean, she wrote beautifully. She kind of wrote as she talked. Those of you who aspire to write, just remember, it's really simple. If you can write as you talk, your writing will be good. Then your talking will get better, too. But most of us, of course, you learn to write in school, so we don't write as we talk. We write as we wrote for our seventh grade teacher, so we could impress her or him by how much we knew. Unfortunately, most academics never escape that, trying to impress somebody by how much they know. It's another subject. But Dana was a farmer. She lived on a farm in New Hampshire, a communal farm. A lot of colleagues, many of whom were working on the same issues. Many of you may remember Danella Meadows as the co-author of The Limits to Growth, one of the books that Raimo put up and showed a couple of the simulation curves and pointing out that, you know, it was all very crazy and radical to most people 50 years ago. It was published actually in 1972, so it's really only a little over 40 years ago. I was at MIT. When it was published, I was a graduate student, and I got to know all the people working on the project, very good friends. But today, of course, we have all these sustainability issues. which is a relatively new, kind of jargony term, not a very good term. A good term, I think it's played a useful function, because I too have been part of using this term. It's played a useful function because it has at least corrected one profound error we were all making for a long time, which was to separate the social and the environmental. So, of course, we have a lot of environmental activists. We have many organizations that have grown up around the world to kind of draw attention to the imbalances we create in the environment. And then we tend to have separate organizations that are drawing attention to the plight of the poor and social inequity. Now, this has been a big error because the two are not separate. Poor people always suffer most when there's environmental stress. And people who are really trying to figure out how they're going to live and if they have any reasonable food for the next few days cannot be good stewards of their natural resources, even if they would really want to do so. So the fragmentation of social and environmental issues has been a big mistake. And ironically, a lot of these same organizations compete for various kinds of philanthropy or government grants. Compete with each other, you know, can you give the money here or do you give the money here? And they don't work together. They're, in a word, not very systemic in their practice, even though they're trying to help the world understand a particular set of very systemic problems. So that, too, kind of identifies one of the key elements. It doesn't really help much to have a systems awareness up here. It all comes down to what we do, how we operate, how we think and act. So I eventually came to this very simple, I guess I would say gut level, you know, here, understanding of all these systems issues before I could really articulate them very well. But as I remember telling my mom, I think there's this one problem. It's the level of interdependence has grown extraordinarily in the world, and we do not understand it. Because I knew very well, as I said, that nobody wanted to produce the consequences that development in Los Angeles had produced. Nobody was trying to accomplish that. And yet that's exactly what was accomplished in a quite a predictable, you could even say systematic manner. Inputs in, outputs out. It's very systematic, very predictable. And I guess that's when I started to understand why this system stuff is so important. The archetypal system for you and I, human beings, for most of us, is the family. And when Raimo had his list of different types of systems, of course, that was up there. Because as human beings, we grow up in families. If we just simply ponder, and I don't mean to impose this, so if it makes sense, just ponder for a moment the suffering that you have seen firsthand produced in families. And that suffering could range from hurt feelings to miscommunication to many, many forms, of course, we know very common of abuse. And then ask yourself the question, is it anybody's goal to produce this suffering? Is anybody trying to hurt feelings or hurt people? And yet we consistently produce those outcomes. That's systems ignorance. And the word is probably not the best word, and I'm only using it to juxtapose it to systems intelligence. But it's probably a pretty technically accurate word. In the Confucian tradition, it's considered a sin to be ignorant. Not a sin like the Western, you know, original sin kind of sin, but really a fundamental error, to be ignorant of that with which you could, if you worked at it, be aware. So we live in a world of systems ignorance, and that's an abstract way to say we live in a world where we consistently produce suffering for each other, for other humans, and for living creatures of all sorts, which nobody intends. And you really don't need to say anything more than that to know why we're sitting in this room. That's it. It's not abstract. It's not intellectual. It's not an argument based on some heavy theory of any sort. It's simply a reflection on our experience. If we really reflect on our experience, we can come to this conclusion.
Let's explore some different kinds of systems. Over the last 18 months, Taxi's been working with 6 rural towns in South Australia as part of the Our Town initiative, funded by the Faye Fuller Foundation. One of the principles of the initiative is to see the big picture. And in the first year, the town teams have been doing just that, trying to understand the dynamics that influence mental well-being in their towns and what can be done about it. Through conversations in their towns and their own experience, the town teams have identified a number of common forces at work. Issues of identity, who it's okay to be in a given town, and underlying forces of racism and homophobia. Cultural norms around seeking support for something like mental health, particularly for men. Unaddressed trauma related to past events, such as the loss of a major industry, issues of reconciliation between Aboriginal and non-Indigenous community members, or disasters such as a bushfire. And the long-term economic prospects of the town and its plan for the future. These factors combine in different ways in different towns, and how they combine will change over time, month by month and year by year. When the towns consider actions to improve mental well-being, clearly, they need to be informed by this deep understanding of the big picture of what's happening, of all the different components that they need to respond to. And this big picture thinking is also called systems thinking. When we use the word system, we often use it to mean a technical system, like a computer system. But that's not how we're using it here. We're thinking about the mental models, the policies, the resource flows, the relationships that holds a particular situation in place. The other common usage of the word system in the social sector is to talk about the formal service system, like the education system or the health system. But what we're thinking about here is more broad than that. For example, whilst the service system might be part of a system of health, it's not the whole picture. Diet, exercise, genetics, family, lifestyle are all part of the holistic picture of a system of health. You could think for a moment about learning. Think about all of the things that create learning or enable learning for you or your children. Think about where children learn, what they learn, who they learn from, and think about the conditions that enable them to learn well or the things that get in the way. And I suspect the big picture that's emerging in your mind right now, well, schools and universities might be part of it, but it's a much richer picture than that. For example, a child's experience of learning would be influenced by how much money their family has, attitudes to learning in their families, and communities, and amongst their peers, if they ate or slept well, or if they were juggling work or caring responsibilities alongside learning.
Since all organisms only exist in a niche, the obvious question for any organism, if you consider its change in its growth as humans, as this particular species has, what's our niche? Which to me leads to a very interesting question. If our niche is to be the planet, what's the consciousness that will require? Because probably, given the particularities of this species, we cannot exist in any niche without some way of thinking, believing, some mythos, some set of ideas, some set of overarching ways of thinking and talking that enable us, since language is so important in how this particular species functions, not unique to us, of course, but very important in how this species functions, that we'll have to have a way of thinking and talking that allows us to exist in a niche. If you spend time with any of the native peoples who have existed in some geographic niche for many thousands of years, you'll immediately discover that they have ways of talking, they have ways of being, they have ceremony, they have cultural praxis, which helps them continually reflect on this awareness. For example, the Blackfeet, the Blackfoot Indians, have no nouns. Theirs is a language with no nouns. By the way, that's the way David Bohm got the idea for the real mode. It was proposed to him by a man named Leroy Little Bear, an elder of the Blackfeet, who was pointing out to him, this is a little conversation Essa and others I have been having. David, of course, very famous physicist, some of you may have heard of him, who just had come to the point where he was convinced that while the mathematics of quantum theory were terribly compelling, very, 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 maybe zero physicists experienced quantum theory. They knew it here. They knew it in their mathematics. They did not know it here and here. And if we don't know something here and here, we really don't know it. And he had come to the conclusion that we should reinvent a language. And he was inspired by this idea that what if you had a language with no nouns? Of course, nouns are a wonderful way of reinforcing a certain confusion. Right? We see things. Nouns give us a perception and a linguistic way of reinforcing a perception of definiteness. This is the way it is. This is a seat. This is a person. These are shoes. Right? None of which, of course, is accurate. It's approximate. It may be useful, but it's not the truth. There's nothing in the physical world that ever stays put, that stays in one form. Form is in a continuous process of flux. You might find it interesting to know that one of the most common phrases the Blackfeet like to use, this is the way of articulating life, they talk of surfing the flux. Surfing the flux. They cannot describe things. They can only describe processes. Now that's a linguistic evolution that has helped them remain harmonious with their geographic niche for 15,000 years. So it's not that human beings cannot do this. We know plenty of examples where human beings can do this. We just don't know a lot, and most of them have been more or less eradicated over the past 100 to 200 years, as this global industrialization process has not only destroyed species, but cultures. Again, the irony. At the very time when we're starting to appreciate a little bit of what we need to know, the sensibility of people who have existed for thousands of years, we're busy doing everything we can to destroy those people. Mary Catherine Bateson is a woman I met through Dana, very interesting woman, anthropologist. Her father was a man named Gregory Bateson, many of you may know in the history of systems. Her mother was a woman named Margaret Mead, who I'm sure many of you know, also a famous anthropologist. And Mary Catherine and I were traveling around South Africa together for about 2 weeks, about just a little before apartheid ended, so this is around 1988 or 89. And I'll never forget, she said to me, I never heard anybody say this before. It really touched me. She said, I have the same passion for the conservation of cultural diversity that a biologist will have for the passion of conservation of species diversity. Nature produces variety. For those of us, every one of us in this room, to a high degree, probably a very, very high degree, who've grown up in the industrial age, which is the age we live in today, it's not over. That's a terrible error to say that the information age replaced the industrial age. Hardly. The information age is the industrial age. Because the whole industrial age has been punctuated by radical shifts in dominant technology. That is the industrial age. Schumpeter was the first one to articulate that in a very clear way. And many have since. In the industrial age, this linguistic consciousness of focusing on things becomes augmented, accelerated, deepened, spread more widely by a fascination with devices. Or as Lewis Mumford wrote many, many years ago, when he, I think, rightly called the industrial age the machine age. And I couldn't help but think, as I was kind of reflecting on the journey of the systems field again, and as Raimo was summarizing it, that so much of that language, so much of the applications, not all, but so much was really to the effective organization of machines and effective machine thinking for the organization of human work. I remember my professors in operations research, and I know that they were really neat people. This is when I was an undergraduate at Stanford before I came to MIT as a graduate student. But there was nothing in them that ever touched me as how I could better understand what it meant to be alive. Most of the systems field is an outgrowth of many different branches of engineering. I, too, am trained as an engineer. My mentors, most of them came out of that tradition. I think it's a wonderful tradition. I think it's provided many tools for understanding interdependence, feedback dynamics, and even in cases when you're serious about it, complex nonlinear feedback dynamics, which start to give you a little feeling for life. But it's very clear to me at this point in time, our survival, in all likelihood, literally depends not on understanding complex systems, which the very word, of course, for 95% probably of the Finnish people, I certainly would say it's 98% of Americans, the very word system sounds like machine. Right? Hey, we have a systems problem around here. We need to get a systems expert. We all know what that typically means. Our computers aren't working correctly. Or, of course, the other most common use of the word system is, hey, it's not my fault, it's the stupid. You ever heard anybody in a company say this? So neither of which is what we're talking about here. A simpler word for here would simply be life, which is by its nature systemic, interdependent, interconnected, continually unfolding, continually in a state of flux. So partly what I'm trying to do to kind of reflect with you on what was evoked as I was sitting listening this morning, obviously just sharing my own personal journey a bit and the kind of key questions that have gradually crystallized for me. And again, I'm just saying this so I can kind of share with you my own way of looking at this. How do we start to close the gap between the interdependence we create and the interdependence we understand? That would be kind of a simple, kind of technical way of saying it. How do we understand the ways of thinking and being that will be required if, in fact, the Earth, the planet itself, is to be our niche? That'll be a slightly different way of saying it. Because, by the way, if that doesn't happen, since we do know, I think this is a pretty good first principle. I mean, it's all just ideas when all is said and done, right? But for me, it's a pretty good first principle that all species only survive in a niche. So therefore, that's a good way to phrase it. And if the answer to that question is we won't develop the ways of the awareness, the ways of thinking, talking, and acting consistent with surviving in the niche called planet Earth, we won't survive in that niche, period. We'll end up maybe in a whole cluster of smaller, more local niches. That's probably not a future any of us would desire, since probably it will only come about in concert with some sort of larger collapse.
This is Tyson Juncker-Porter and Melanie Goldchild talking about their perspective on Indigenous systems thinking. This is taken from Tyson Juncker-Porter's podcast, The Other Others.
Good morning here on Boonwurrung country, and So Melanie Goodchild from the Turtle Island Institute, we're having a good yarn today. Well, it's today for me, it's tonight for you.
It is. It's 7 p.m. here in Niagara Falls in Haudenosaunee and Three Fires Confederacy territory. So I'm just having my after dinner tea.
Well, Melanie, would you like to introduce yourself and what you do, and feel free to use any language you like. And don't feel compelled to provide a translation.
All right, miigwech. So bonjour and tena maganaduk. Apajigo miigwech bizindaviyug. Moose and dodem. Nishnabe kweanda. Biktagong nishnabe. Donjaba kiriganzibi. Donjaba. Those are the First Nations. In jinakade ishkonigen wenjian that I come from. Wapshke ogechidakwe is an ang indigenous cause. Waba anang akwe indigenous cause. Those Anishinaabe Mangadash are the names I'm known by in the spirit world. And then Melanie, Indigenous Cause Jaganashiayang, that's what I'm also called in English. And I'm here in Niagara Falls, Ontario. So I'm the founder and co-director of Turtle Island Institute. And we look at complexity and systems thinking from a uniquely Anishinaabe lens. So really focusing on, you know, what does... How does that help me? And we do that with the guidance of a medicine bundle. So in part of my introduction is I'm also keeping a medicine bundle for Turtle Island Institute, which has a Migazé Miguan, an eagle feather, and Miganak Shishiguan, a turtle rattle. And that feather and that rattle both teach us about coexistence and peaceful coexistence of different ways of knowing. So that's the medicine, the mushkiki that we try to bring to our work in systems change.
And we've sort of come together, our relationships sort of built, you know, around that turtle story, and but also quite strongly around eagle story, you know, and you connected that way with my spouse, who has that totemic relation there with that Guritala. She's from Barada country there. And look, this you know, indigenous systems thinking, you know, how you might say in English, or complexity science, you know, which has just been our part of our method of inquiry, you know, a cornerstone of our method of inquiry for so many thousands of years as indigenous peoples, you know, it's not something that's that we've kind of had language for in English, you know, yet, but it's very much an idea whose time has come. And so, you know, I'm sort of looking to Turtle Island Institute for mentorship around these sorts of things as I continue to set up the Indigenous Knowledge Systems Lab at Deakin University, down here in Victoria. I believe you guys have a Victoria up there as well, because, you know, same queen at some stage.
Yeah, that's
occupying.
Right.
Yeah,
we do have a Victoria, British Columbia, on, and there you go, British Columbia.
Yeah,
we have a lot of the. I think it's, you know, when I hear you talk about the new institute that you're kind of launching into the world, I think that. When I hear the words complexity in systems, you know, it's sort of so natural in some ways, and yet it's so difficult for some people to bridge, because we've been socialized into a reductive, mechanistic way. But I heard, or I've shared recently, I guess, the concept of systems and complexity as irreducible wholeness. I like that. In terms of English, you know, that might be a good way to capture the irreducible wholeness and the recognition that systems, living systems, are about relationships and the interconnection between all of the parts. And to me, that sounds really resonant with, you know, our ancestral, we say Anishinaabe Gikindoswin, our ancestral ways of understanding the world.
Yeah. And we do have words for that and phrases and language around that, but it's funny. I mean, in the same way as, you know, we have these temporary names that are mapped over places like, you know, Victoria, British Columbia, things like this, you know, these are temporary names. in the same way, I sort of see complexity and systems thinking, these as temporary placeholders as well for names. Not that we'll be replaced, you know, with indigenized names down the track, but just, I don't know, we can use them in the meantime to communicate about something that really shouldn't have a name. We don't have names for these things, you know, in the language. Hopefully, eventually, people will stop talking about complexity, and it's just like, well, yeah, no, that's life. And then when I think about it, there's not even in, I can't even think of a word for that abstract concept of life, you know, in Wik language, from back up home with my family there, up in the north of Australia, North Queensland. I can't think of a word for life as an abstract either, you know. Yeah, these things just are. You don't need to abstract them into infinity. Yeah.
Exactly. And I think, I mean, that's why maybe it's difficult sometimes for folks to recognize their part of systems, and because it sounds like something external to us, like, you know, the system let us down, we need to change the system, as if it has a life of its own, when really we're embedded in those relationships, we're a part of them. And I think about, you know, when you were just mentioning language, when I was first studying systems, it was through social and ecological sustainability. I was studying resilience thinking, complexity, and systems, you know, what we call complex social ecological adaptive systems.
Right.
And I kept hearing words like wilderness, nature, ecology, environment. And I thought, gee. And so I texted an elder back home, Albert Hunter in Manitou Rapids, back in Treaty 3, back home in the north where I come from. And I said, I've never heard anyone say in our language, Anishinaabemowin, like I've never heard anything translated as nature. And he said, no, we say Gidakimanan, and it means everything. Everything in creation, the sun, the moon, the stars, the trees, the water, mountains, and your sacred place in creation. He said, we just say everything. So there is no separation. And like you said, there's sort of an abstraction of nature, and that disconnect is fueled by the language of the colonizer in terms of English. It really predisposes us in some ways to an anthropocentric bias. This is sort of what I've come to realize, you know, there's things, they're nouns, they're an it. Mm. How can you think of the wind as a relative if it's a thing, or the earth herself, or the sun?
Yeah.
And so beautiful multi-layered lessons in our languages.
Well, even our technologies, you know, these are not separate from those things. You know, there's no concept of a synthetic, you know, thing that you might make, because these things are part of nature as well. That isn't even nature, it's everything. But you know, you follow those patterns of creation in the making, and then the entire life cycle of an object that you might make, or a technology, or, you know, a network of technologies that are sitting within an economy that's also embedded within that landscape. You know, which is you, which is culture, which is land, which is creation, and everything, spirit right through, you know. So this idea of there being a technology, and then there being you know, there being a nature, and then there being technology as this thing that's kind of separate from nature as well, in the same way that something abstract like society is separate from nature. And you know, it's a bit terrifying, isn't it? The idea that you have to separate in order to have one of these civilizations.
Mm-hmm. The, you know, and the whole premise of human beings being separate from nature was in service of commodification of nature, of, you know, the powers that wanted to access resources, for example. And so that kind of relationship and that land was, you know, something that we lived on and in relationship with as a relative, and had no concept of ownership. And then that's what was used against us to say, well, you don't own the land, so we're gonna steal it. And the disconnection and the disenfranchisement from land has affected our ceremonies, because now there are, you know, indigenous peoples around the world that can no longer access sacred sites. And so they adapt, but there are ceremonies that are no longer performed and therefore parts of our language. And so I think revitalizing that through systems work and complexity, that's the link that's really, for me, so appealing about, you know, the what you'll be tackling with the Institute is just the inner work that needs to be done as a human being on this, you know, as a spirit being really on a human journey. Is there's an elder that works with us, Laura Horton, that calls it the concept of biscobaying, which is to sort of go back and look at your past and how you've been personally affected by that history so that you can revitalize and address things and recapture them. And I've found in systems thinking and complexity, and hopefully we don't have to call it that someday, that it's just going to be my sister and her mom's an elder who's passed away. But when she was here, she says, you have to remember how to think like an Indian. And that's, to me, that's as simple as what complexity and system thinking is thinking like an Indian, is to think like our ancestors did. And that's how we're going to be able to manage the, in some ways, the polarities. And I've heard an Andean elder talk about somewhat, you know, this concept of the medicine of polarities. And that's really resonated with me recently, thinking about how polarities are often defined as either or, like the binary thinking that that's all that there is. And I think systems is about that there's much more than that. And it's actually exciting and it's hopeful.
But there's a kind of double work in the type of work that we're trying to do, in that you can't just do the inquiry, which is, you know, what we do anyway in our lives. You know, that's just, you're a researcher, you know, you're Indigenous, you're a researcher, you don't even know it, but you're conducting inquiry all the time into the world around you. But yeah, there's a double work in this, because we're doing the inquiry, but then we have to be translator as well as researcher. And so, you know, we have to do things like, you know, looking at our, you know, complexity, and then seeking to break that down into, well, what are the elements of that that we can translate for others who think in that way?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've found sort of being a bridge, quite literally, to embody that bridging when I'm speaking to different audiences between Western concepts of complexity and system and Anishinaabe, Gik, and Oswin, because there's a bit of a cognitive dissonance that happens on either side. So when elders are first introduced to these ideas, there's a dissonance there because it sounds so familiar to them. And then vice versa, when scientists are introduced to Indigenous knowledge, there's a dissonance because it sounds so familiar, yet it's spiritual. And they're not quite sure what to do with the spiritual nature, you know, like the idea of being in relationship and kin with the natural world, as we say in English. And then there's either a response of hostility, like a pushback to, no, I'm a scientist, or there's a relief. And I've been hearing more recently about this sense of relief that it's not a binary either or, that you're actually, you know, talking about a relationship to the cosmos, to your ancestors, and that everybody has ancestors. So it's been interesting because I do a lot of cross-cultural work, and hearing the way that the elders talk about future generations and the unborn generations, and then hearing science, even climate scientists, still having this anthropocentric kind of mindset, you know, that Mother Earth is still here to serve us. So a lot of this work is about shifting mindsets or mental models. And that's deep work. That actually involves a lot of healing, but, you know, we don't always talk about it that way. I'll do an introduction to systems thinking and complexity. And by the end of the workshop or the conversation, folks will realize, wow, that was very healing. And it was a sense of relief because people are grieving. I think lots of human beings are grieving the disconnect to being able to listen to the frequencies of the land.
Yeah, it's funny, I mean, the mental acrobatics that you have to do in that act of translation, you know, in order to bring people, you know, back under that law of the land, it kind of produces a halfway language. Like, there's elements of like, you know, patterns of indigenous thought, you know, coming into the English that we're using. You know, so like right at the start of everything you just said, then I noticed how you were turning that noun into a verb. You know, you were saying, you know, like being a bridge and bridging, you know, rather than talking about a translation is a bridge mm-hmm. between two worlds. You know, you were talking about yourself being a bridge, you know, mm-hmm. And putting yourself into that bridge. You know, like you are part of it, you're in relation to it. So there's, you know, everything changes with the language. And I think we need to do that because it's that same thing. It's a very simple concept that you and I are trying to get across in the world. And it's very difficult, even, you know, speaking to other Indigenous people, but anyone around has been so used to, you know, for so long, Indigenous knowledge being about Indigenous people. Like from the outside looking in, and to Indigenous, you know, research being, you know, by and for Indigenous people. So looking inward as well, you know, a lot of it looking at all the problems, you know, that are caused by imperialism and colonization and addressing, you know, the results of that colonization on the ground, you know, so, we use that metaphor of like treating a rash, you know, by putting the ointment on the rash rather than looking at the big candidal infection across the body. You know, people are used to that idea of, you know, Indigenous knowledge being about Indigenous things, you know, and for Indigenous communities. But it's very difficult to turn that gaze outward and to get that idea across of, you know, that you're not just trying to dry yourself from the feet up.
Right.
While the shower is still running. Right. You know what I mean? You know, that idea of, well, how can we apply Indigenous knowledge systems and patterns of logic and being? How can we apply those to solving problems in the world, the wider world, you know, beyond our communities, you know, in order to, you know, basically turn the shower off so we've got a hope of getting dry in the first place? It's a very difficult concept to get across, don't you find?
I have found that, you know, to be honest, when when I talk about different concepts, I'll often reach out to language speakers because it's the construction of the word bundle, that's so informative, and the nouns. And then when we were starting, you know, something called Turtle Island Institute, which is a teaching lodge, one of the elders back home, she said, Eleanor Skeed, my sister, she said, well, what you are practicing is Gichiga Kinoamatwin, which is the act of greater deep teaching, which is very different than a teaching lodge. So in English, you know, I'll say, well, we're a teaching lodge, in addition to being a social innovation think and do tank, which makes sense, you know, in certain contexts. When we say teaching lodge, that makes sense to us. But Gichiga Kinoamatwin, the act of greater deep teaching, is the process that we're engaged in because we're building our Minigojiwin, which is our knowledge bundle.
A verb again.
Mm-hmm.
It's a verb again. Yeah. It's about the process, and that's, you know, Indigenous knowledge, IK, you know, TEK, all this. It's never about the content. It's always about the process and the doing.
And the process is what people don't have the patience for. That's what I found is, you know, we're very outcome oriented, whether it's funding, it's government, it's policy. Like, we're really students, the way they learn, you know, what are the instructions? What's my grade? How do I get an A? And it's the, what if we were focused on the process of learning? And
silence all stand. The Federal Court of Australia is now in session. Be seated, please.
Please call on the matter.
Calling BID 607 of 2020. Anjali Sharma and others by their litigation representative, Sister Marie Bridget Arthur, and Minister for the Environment, for judgment.
To take a systems view is to take the long view and establish what can be done now to move towards a preferred future, recognising that that's going to take some time. But this long view thinking and seeing runs counter to the norms of short-term thinking that dominate. And there's no more vivid illustration of this than the phenomena of children around the world taking their own governments to court about their failure to act on climate change. The aim of the children is to have the courts find governments legally responsible for thinking about the future and negligent in thinking only about the short term.
The 100 million tonnes of CO2 attributable to the burning of coal from the Extension Project is likely to cause a tiny but measurable increase to global average surface temperatures. In doing so, it would increase the risk of global average surface temperatures increasing beyond 2 degrees Celsius and the risk of global surface temperatures being propelled into an irreversible 4 degrees Celsius trajectory. In my assessment, that risk is real, meaning that it may be remote, but it is not far-fetched or fanciful. Furthermore, the evidence has demonstrated that the risk of harm to the children from climatic hazards brought about by increased global average surface temperatures is on a continuum in which both the degree of risk and the magnitude of the potential harm increases exponentially if the Earth moves beyond a global average surface temperature of 2 degrees Celsius towards 3 degrees Celsius and then to 4 degrees Celsius above the pre-industrial level. The nature and extent of the harm that may be experienced by the children is detailed in sections 5.1 and 5.3 of my reasons. Those potential harms may fairly be described as catastrophic, particularly should global average surface temperatures rise to and exceed 3 degrees Celsius beyond the pre-industrial level. Perhaps the most startling of the potential harms demonstrated by the evidence before the court is that 1 million of today's Australian children are expected to suffer at least one heat stress episode serious enough to require acute care in a hospital. Many thousands will suffer premature death from heat stress or bushfire smoke. Substantial economic loss and property damage will be experienced. The Great Barrier Reef and most of Australia's eastern eucalypt forests will no longer exist due to repeated severe bushfires. The law of negligence focuses on the foreseeability of future harm and the relationship between the person who has caused or contributed to the harm and the person or persons who may be harmed. The evidence demonstrates that a reasonable person in the position of the minister would foresee that, by reason of the Extension Project's effect on increased CO2 in the Earth's atmosphere and the consequential increase in global surface temperatures, each of the children is exposed to a risk of death or other personal injury. The evidence therefore establishes an essential precondition for the law of negligence to recognise a duty of care owed by the minister to each of the children. There are, however, other matters that need to be considered before a duty of care can be recognised. Having weighed and balanced those considerations, the court is satisfied that a duty of care should be recognised. Accordingly, the court has determined that the minister has a duty of care to take reasonable care not to cause the children personal injury when exercising her power under section 130 and 133 of the EPPC Act to approve or not approve the extension project.
And this is Ava Princi speaking on the steps of the Australian Federal High Court a few weeks ago, one of eight children who took the Minister for the Environment to court with the aims of halting further investment in fossil fuels.
Thank you for your interest in today's judgment. My name is Ava Princi, I'm 17 years old, and I'm one of eight students who brought this class action against the Federal Environment Minister. Today's judgment is both thrilling and deeply relieving. The judge has recognised that the Minister has a duty to take reasonable care not to cause us injury resulting from climate change. The court did not order an injunction stopping the mine, but it's not over yet. There will be further submissions on what the duty of care means for the Minister's decision and the mine. I'm thrilled because this is a landmark decision. This is the first time a court of law anywhere in the world has recognised that a government minister has a duty of care to protect young people from the catastrophic harms of climate change. My future and the future of all young people depends on Australia stepping away from fossil fuel projects and joining the world in taking decisive climate action. The court accepted our evidence that the emissions released from the mining and burning of fossil fuels will contribute to serious and wide-ranging physical, mental, and financial harm to young people. The law now recognises that the Environment Minister is in a special position of power to prevent foreseeable harms to young people. I feel elated by this decision, and this is not over. This case was about young people stepping up and demanding more from the adults whose actions are determining our future well-being. The class action was filed on behalf of all young people around the world. We received almost 2,000 messages of support from people in 39 countries on every continent, young people whose communities, health, and livelihoods are under threat from the same global climate crisis. Young people have an enormously powerful voice, and my fellow litigants and I hope that this case inspires more of us everywhere in the world to push for stronger, faster, and deeper cuts to carbon emissions.
So a third way to articulate my dilemma or puzzle I wanted to share with you is that. How do we fall in love once again with the world? Not just with another, not just with those close enough to us, but with our life and with the world. In the last 5 to 10 years, I've spent most of my time working in education. I'm traveling a little tour around the world with my colleague from Denmark here, Dr. Mette Bo, who's kind of helping to knit together remarkable innovators in education. And from this experience, one of the things I've seen, not from this last few months, but over the last 10 years, watching systems ideas and tools for understanding systems in the hands of 3-year-olds, 4-year-olds, 5-year-olds, you will be stunned to see that innate systems intelligence showing up. The best analogy I've been able to kind of find for this, imagine, you know, children were never given a musical instrument. There would not be a lot of musicians in the world. Children are not given any of the tools and artifacts and processes to cultivate their innate systems intelligence. But we're born with musical intelligence. The instrument allows us to cultivate it, or the joining together and singing in some sort of organized process of singing together allows us to cultivate it. We have none of that for systems intelligence. But we have immense innate systems intelligence. It's who we are. We are a loving systems intelligence species. And the various gaps I was trying to characterize before will only be closed. Come to the conclusion, in my opinion, will only be closed if we discover that again. Essa.
There's many ways to think about how a system is structured. What's below the water? But at the base of nearly every model, in the deepest water, are mental models and cultural norms, the things in a system that underpin everything else. There's a way of looking at social innovation as a set of methods and tools, something that's just below the waterline, something that existing institutions can pick up on and apply to long-standing social challenges. But there's a more fundamental way to see social innovation. As a philosophy that challenges many of the ways of thinking in industrial society, ways of thinking that have become so habitual now that we don't even recognize we're doing them. The norms that are structured into our social systems, our education systems, our workplace culture, our government, our media, even the toys we play with as a child. Systems thinking asks us to see holistically and to see ourselves as part of the world, not separate from it. Yet Western habits of thought, we typically see ourselves as individuals and as separate from nature. Systems thinking challenges us to think about longer time frames and act now to create change. As those children around the world have been doing by taking their own governments to court. But the very fact this has to happen is an indication of how short-termism is institutionalized in our societies. The holism of systems thinking is an affront to the simplification and linear thinking so often promoted by our media and our politicians. The idea that if you do A, it will almost certainly lead to B. For example, build roads to ease traffic congestion, open prisons to reduce crime, increase services to improve mental health, turn back the boats to keep out the refugees, respond to climate change, and lose jobs. But that's not what happens in real life. Systems thinking also challenges dominant scientific and academic norms, that of reductionism, the idea that if we separate and isolate things from the whole and develop ever more niche specialisms, we can understand the world better. And in social innovation, it's not just systems thinking that provides a challenge to cultural norms. It's innovation and people power too. Innovation challenges a kind of theoreticism that dominates social problem solving, a belief that with the right evidence, enough thought, and or a dash of ideology, complex problems can be solved in advance, in the abstract, without learning through doing. And what we call people power at Taxi, the idea that we'll get to better solutions if citizens, including and especially those that are marginalised by existing systems, have greater say and greater control in public problem solving and in public futures. Well, this can be seen as a direct attack on professionalism, educational elitism, patriarchy, and racism, to name just a few. And earlier in Finzi, we've been exploring well-being. I described a focus on well-being government as an innovation. But another way to see it is that social innovation's focus on well-being provides a direct challenge to the ideology of capitalism, because it puts investment in human capital at the top of the agenda. And that investment in human growth and equity is in conflict with unchecked growth at the expense of the environment and the continued concentration of wealth. Altogether, the challenge of mental models says something about the personal journey individuals and communities need to travel if they're to truly embrace social innovation. It points to the importance of the spiritual aspect of systems change. But these kinds of transformation are possible. As Peter Senge wrote in the preface to Theory U, we're not powerless to alter the dominant trends of the industrial age. These trends are based not on the laws of physics, but on human habits, albeit habits at a large scale. These habitual ways of thinking and acting become embedded over time in social structures we enact. But alternative social structures can also be created. Achieving the changes needed means nothing less than creating the world anew, based on a radically different view.